You're listening to a podcast edition of Closer to Truth. For more information about this series, visit our website, closertotruth.com.
Welcome to Closer to Truth. I'm speaking with Professor Helen DeCruz about her thought-provoking, engaging, and visionary new book, Wonderstruck, How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think, in which Helen, as a philosopher of both cognitive science and of religion, explores the transformative role of wonder and awe in an uncertain world. Helen, welcome. It's great to see you again.
It's great to see you again, Robert.
Good. Well, congratulations on Wonderstruck. I loved reading it and going through so much rich material. The overarching concept of the importance of wonder and awe is extremely important. We'll discuss it in great depth. But first, I have just an opening question based on your remarkable diversity in intellectual endeavors. Both of your primary interests, you have many interests, but the two primary ones are philosophy of cognitive science and philosophy of religion. And both are on the ascent in both the academy and the global public square. Now, I can understand why philosophy of cognitive science is rising. That's easy to explain. The stunning emergence of AI by itself would do that. But why philosophy of religions rise? Because, you know, in the early and middle decades of the last century, many would have predicted that it would have gradually faded away.
People have been predicting this, honestly, since the 18th century, right? That religion would go away and would give rise to, well, would give way to reason. But here we are, right? I mean, current conflicts in the world, I don't even have to mention any specifically, show that religion continues to have this important role in people's lives, that people invest so much in it. So I want to understand what's going on. I want to understand why is religion so appealing to us? Like, what is it about religion?
Yeah, and there are so many facets to it. It is the sociological impact that you're referring to, but also the deep philosophical questions that that can be explored. And, you know, we do that on Closer to Truth. We have a third or so, 30% of Closer to Truth dealing with the philosophy of different religions. You've participated with us in two new series we have on Eastern traditions and big questions and global philosophy of religion, looking at the some deep questions on a comparative basis. And there's some rich human understanding there too.
Yeah, that's right. So I think no matter what people's circumstances, I think that religion does show the phenomenon of religion, that people have these enduring questions about, like, what is ultimate reality like? You know, what is a good way to live? And religions are precisely the sorts of cultural institutions and practices that help us to deal with these questions.
Hmm. And also from an intellectual point of view, you know, you're now editor of, this is going to be part of your bio that I'm going to give, but it's relevant now. You're editor-in-chief of Res Philosophica at St. Louis University, dealing with these questions. You have been executive editor of the Journal of Analytic Theology, which we've followed for a while, and managing editor for Faith and Philosophy, one of the leading magazines in relationship between science and between religion and philosophy, dealing with a lot of these issues. So the issue is not just what's happening in the world, but what's happening as we try to discern the nature of ultimate reality on a very scholarly level.
That's right. So it's interesting to note that at Res Philosophica, we do get a fair number of philosophy of religion submissions that I found surprising. But in a sense, it is also because, you know, the journal does have a history, a tradition, even though it's a general journal to have an emphasis or an interest in philosophy of religion. And it's kind of interesting because if you had like 50 years ago, if you looked at philosophy journals, then religion would be quite marginalized. So it's actually really a renaissance of thinking about religion and thinking philosophically engaging with religious questions.
Well, religion is a part of your book, Wonderstruck, but it's only a part. There's science and magic, which we're going to talk about. But let me do this. Let me just give a brief, more formal introduction, which I didn't do at the opening, but let me do it now very briefly. Helen DeCruz holds the Danforth Chair in the Humanities at St. Louis University, and she has two PhDs, the first in archaeology and art sciences, and her second PhD in philosophy. And she's published in philosophy, we've said, philosophy of cognitive science, philosophy of religion, but also philosophy of science itself, epistemology, aesthetics, and metaphilosophy, as well as being these journal editors. So, Helen, let's begin with some what I call framing questions, and then we'll go through the arc of Wonderstruck, the book, and see the flow. So let's start. Can't get more basic than this, than defining wonder and awe, which is a nice sort of phrase, but I'd like to particularly distinguish between them, because we use it as a phrase and it's sort of all compensating, but there's a difference. What is the difference between wonder and awe?
For the longest time, there was actually no difference. So if we look at, say, ancient philosophy, so ancient Greek philosophy, where actually we see in Western philosophy, we see that those concepts come up for the first time. So you've got like Plato and Aristotle, and they talk about to taumazein, to wonder, as this sort of, you know, and that also means awe. So wonder and awe are basically similar in that respect. And if you then look at medieval philosophy, it's similar. So in medieval philosophy, you also have wonder and awe, which are sort of packaged in this one idea. But in the early modern period, they start to diverge. So if you have an author like, say, Adam Smith, he begins to distinguish between wonder and awe, where wonder is more the sort of the being interested in something that is unusual, something that you can't, that you didn't expect, and that you try to get to grips with. So on the other hand, awe also has this dimension of vastness to it. So you've got like starry skies and tempestuous oceans and things like that, like what they call in the 18th century the sublime. So with awe, there is this dimension of vastness. And with wonder, there is more sort of like this dimension of enduring puzzlement that doesn't necessarily have the dimension of vastness. So that's how we distinguish between those two.
That's very good. Wonder, you can wonder about something that has no awe. I mean, you can wonder why something works, and it's not, you don't feel a sense of awe because of that, but you still have a sense of wonder. And as we get into science and how wonder and awe may motivate science, we'll need to distinguish between one and the other, because in my original career in neuroscience, I had a lot of wonder, but at least what I was working on, I didn't have any awe. I had awe about a lot of other things, and that's the and closer to truth is a response to my awe. But in my scientific career, in terms of what I was doing, I didn't have any awe. I just had a lot of wonder. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. So with wonder, there is really a sort of push to investigate. With awe, there is more this sort of thing like, wow, I don't know even how to begin to deal with it. And eventually you can begin to deal with it. But I would say that, yes, with awe, there is more this sort of like, you know, just standing with this big thing that's much bigger than you.
Okay, that's clear. I like that distinction. That's very clear. You use a term that when we have awe or wonder, we make a cognitive accommodation in terms of reaction. What specifically for wonder and awe is a cognitive accommodation?
Yeah, so they prompt what psychologists like Keltner and Haidt, so they wrote a paper on awe in 2003, where they put this concept of cognitive accommodation centrally. And the idea is that you have to try to find somehow something to deal with the phenomenon that causes awe or wonder. So basically, the idea is that there's something that you didn't expect. It's like you don't have an existing framework yet for it. So you have to try to find a way to make it fit, the thing that caused wonder or awe, in your picture of the world. And that's why those emotions are basically why they are epistemic, which means they are emotions that are really primarily concerned with gaining knowledge, because you're trying to get more information, more knowledge to try to deal with, try to cognitively accommodate these things.
So wonder and awe in terms of their commonality leaves you empty of something. Once you have that feeling, you need to get something else in order to fill that gap, because it creates some kind of cognitive gap. So you have to do in order to deal with it.
That's right. Yeah. So you have to do something. Like it could be just an emotional reaction where you say, okay, this is much bigger than me. There's clearly a lot I don't know. That could be one way to deal with it. Or you could say, I want to find out more about this thing and then investigate. So that's the other way. And those are two possible ways.
Yeah, and for each, you distinguish two kinds of emotion. One is epistemic, which you've just described. In other words, you want more access to knowledge about it or have some kind of reaction. And the other is transcendent emotion.
That's right.
You have those two approaches. Now, just superficially, the transcendent part would seem more to fit with the awe than with the wonder.
Yes, but even with the wonder, so it's self-transcendent in the sense that just like with other such emotions, like, for example, compassion. So when you feel compassion, you're no longer thinking about yourself, but the other person that you feel compassion for or love is also self-transcendent. But with wonder too, I would say, like, it's not about you anymore. It's about this thing that you're wondering at. So it also pushes you out.
Very good distinction. And I think I was reacting to the more common use of the word transcendent in the terms of some gigantic thing in terms of ultimate reality. But you're using transcendent in its proper, very specific, is just something beyond yourself. So if it's a compassion for a hurt animal on the road, that's a transcendent experience as you're defining it, because it's something beyond myself.
That's right. Yeah. So it doesn't need to be like a wow moment. You could wonder a little bit as well. Like this comes in degrees, right?
So I understand the importance of wonder and awe in some of these big areas that we'll talk about, science, religion, etc. But you go beyond that. You have wonder and awe being not as rare as I might think some special event, but you have it more lying at the heart of life's, you know, many different things that we do on a kind of a regular basis. So you're looking at wonder and awe as more part of our normal way of life, as opposed to just these spectacular, strange moments.
So one reason to think that it's common is actually that we know from psychological research that it's very common. So there's been various ways to study this. For example, diary studies. So people keep diaries about when do you have a moment of wonder and awe. And it's actually really common. And the other surprising thing is that it's not just like, okay, imagine if you're an oceanographer or, you know, you host Closer to Truth or something, that you would have wonder and awe the whole time. That seems normal. But actually, even if you're like, say, a janitor or something, also has moments of awe and wonder. Like, so it doesn't matter what your profession is and the like, it seems to be something that people experience regularly. Now, there are clearly peak moments. For example, childbirth is often mentioned as this moment that people are really in awe, because this is such a special, overwhelming situation. But there's also things like, you know, I don't know, like frost on the window and you see beautiful patterns. Like, this seems mundane, but it is still something that gives a sense of wonder.
Mm. You also talk about wonder and awe as being drivers that motivate us as individuals and humanity collectively to inquire and discover new things and obviously advance civilization. So it's obviously important. But as I was reading that in your terrific book, I was thinking, do you distinguish in terms of the selectivity of awe and during an evolutionary process? We'll maybe talk a little bit about it later. But between a biological selection based on fitness and the traditional evolutionary drivers, or culturally encouraged? Or can you distinguish between those two?
That is such a tough question. Honestly, I found that difficult, the most difficult thing to deal with. Like, is awe and is wonder a biological driver, or is it something more cultural? And there's a lot of discussion about that in emotion research as well, right? But I think actually the way to think of this is that humans, they have so much culture enmeshed in our way of living that any question that you have to ask about that, you'll have to sort of look at, like, how does culture and nature interact in giving these things? And I think that's the case with awe and wonder, right? And I think that's the case with emotions in general. So I think there is a biological basis for being curious, for being surprised, for those sorts of things, like what I call epistemic emotions, right? So that's evolutionary, right? You'd see it in non-human animals. You see, like, my cat tries to find a way out of the house, a different way out of the house, for example. Or you see, like, a bird flies, you know, rather this way than that. And it's useful for the bird because maybe the bird finds a better place to nest. Mm. So curiosity doesn't kill the cat usually. You know, usually it helps the cat to do things better. So I think that's the biological side of that. So next to that, there is also the cultural side where, you know, you have to sort of try to keep your curiosity, your awe, your wonder, those sorts of emotions, you can keep them alive. You can sort of feed them, nurture them with specific practices. So I think it's both.
I had a personal experience with that. I was watching my granddaughter, who's now 15, when she was barely could walk, like a year and a half, and she had a walker, some kind of toy, and she was just walking around with that newfound experience of being able to walk the first time. And then there was a little chair, and she kept pushing the chair because she wanted to go to the other side, and it didn't work, and she couldn't go through it. And then she slipped. And when she slipped, she went around the chair. And at that moment, she knew that the way you get to the other side of things is to go around them, not through them. And from then on, she never tried to go through things again. And it was just that aha instant moment. And actually that filled me with some kind of awe to see that first experience in life that will have, you know, as we call it, a one trial learning. And it was had such an impact.
And you bring up something so important in the case of wonder. So Descartes, who, as you know, in the book, I use Descartes' account of wonder as a sort of guiding thread throughout the book. He thinks what is super important about wonder is the seeing something for the first time, or seeing it as if for the first time. And in this case, with your granddaughter, it's just like you have not seen this before, and she never saw it before. And I think that firstness was really central in the experience.
Yeah, it really was, and it really made a lasting impression. All right, let's go through the book. Wonderful book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And just to give a kind of a conceptual outline, why don't you just take literally a minute and give your sense of the overall arc of the eight or so chapters that you have? What is the intellectual structure that you want to convey? Because it's a very clear movement through the book.
Yeah. So my overall aim for the book was to give a sense of what does wonder and awe do for us? Like, how is it useful as an emotion? How are these two useful emotions? And so in the first book, I outline a general picture of what human culture does, because I'm thinking those emotions are partly cultural, as I said. And I think that one of the main thing about human culture to keep in mind is that it serves human needs. So we have certain needs, certain, you know, ideas, certain requirements, and awe and wonder help us to fulfill certain needs to know, needs to be taken, you know, outside of ourselves. And then the second chapter sketches an intellectual history that goes from ancient Greek philosophy up until sort of like more the 18th, 19th century, when you have the big conceptual work that was being done about wonder and awe in Western philosophy. So we get a sense of Plato and Aristotle talking about, you know, what they thought that wonder is specifically a philosophical emotion, particularly Plato has this idea. And then we go on with Descartes and Adam Smith and so forth. And then in the third book, I outline a theory of emotions, which sort of strikes a middle ground between, on the one hand, the sort of hyper-Darwinian, like emotions are just like purely hardwired, there's just a few of them, you know, like Darwin and Ekman and people like that. And then on the other hand, emotions are more like cultural things, like Lisa Barrett says. And I sort of strike, I think, a middle way between those two, and saying that Owen Wander are actually both. So they do have a biological basis, but the fact that we distinguish between these emotions also indicates that we have sort of culturally developed actually a way to wonder and to stand in awe. And I give some examples. Then chapter 4 is about magic, which is like an interesting topic in the sense that philosophers don't talk about magic anymore, but they used to. They used to be super interested in magic.
I didn't know that.
I'm looking at like, yeah, they were so interested in magic. In the 16th century, you had like the great Renaissance humanists, so like Pico de la Mirandola and people like that. And Bruno, of course, Giordano Bruno was very interested in magic. So then I look at what does wonder, how does wonder relate to magic? And why are we so interested in magic? Like, what's cool about magic? Why are we continuously doing it? And then chapter 5 is about religion. And that basically looks at wonder and its role in our religious thinking, wonder and awe. And then 6 is about science. And there I try to solve this problem. Does science dispel our sense of awe and wonder? And that's been a topic that many philosophers have talked about and many scientists as well. Richard Dawkins, for example. And I say, actually, yeah, science tries to do this. Science tries to find out what it is and make us stop wondering. But at the same time, we keep on wondering. And science is this enormous sense of source of wonder. So that's a paradox. And then 7 is about, I talk about wonder and awe as emotions. But in 7, I explore the idea that there might also be virtues. And I use Rachel Carson's ideas to draw on a sort of virtue theoretical account of awe and wonder. And then chapter 8 is basically a wondering about like, okay, it seems like even though we wonder regularly, it seems like it's sort of dried up a little bit. Like why do we find it hard to wonder? Like what's happening and why is it important to keep on doing so? So that's sort of in rough outline.
Yeah, that's what the book is about. That's terrific. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick out some areas that I find interesting. Everything is still self-serving and we'll talk about that. But that's why everybody knows that they have this wonderful arc of information. It's very rich throughout the book. So Helen, you got me from chapter 1, right at the beginning. I loved where you were talking about the outlandish, your term, amount of time and energy that humanity seems to focus on a number of kinds of things. And the examples you used were just wonderful. And I'm just giving 3. One had to do with art, and you mentioned African masks, which are elaborate and fantastic. And then you mentioned the Collatz conjecture in mathematics, which I'll get back to. And then the third was rationalizing how the Trinity in Christian theology is really only one God. Now, we've dealt a lot with the latter, more recently with art. So all of those are surely reflections, and outlandish doesn't mean bad. It means something that we want to ask about. Why has humanity spent so much time on this stuff? Now, I'm going to briefly mention the Collatz conjecture. You know, we deal with mathematics on Closer to Truth, so that really, really hit me. It seems like the simplest thing in the world. It's a conjecture that says that, if I get this right, that pick any number, and if it's an even number, the next number in a sequence, divide it in half. If it's an odd number, you multiply it by 3 and add 1. And then you just keep doing that, just those two operations. And the conjecture is that at some point, soon, eventually, maybe in a long time, but always, you will get the number 1 in that sequence, and then you stop. And the conjecture says, can you prove that that's the case, that you do these two operations, and that every single time, without exception, no matter what number you pick, you'll wind up with a 1. Mm-hmm. And nobody has been able to prove that, but they've run computer tests, and they test numbers, and they've gone up to almost 3 × 10²⁰. I think that's 100 billion billion in terms of numbers, and there's been no exception. But they still can't prove it, yet they're still spending you know, careers based on trying. So those three examples of art, the Collett's conjecture, and the Trinity just exemplify humanity's approach to wonder and awe. So I thought that was wonderful.
I am so intrigued by the Collett's conjecture. It's one of those things that I think perfectly exemplify. People have tried so much. Like, I saw an interview with Terence Tao, that great mathematician,
yeah,
and he said he had put boundary conditions on it somehow. I forgot exactly what he had done, but he moved a little bit.
Yeah,
he'd moved a little bit closer towards it. And I thought, like, why do we spend all this time? Like, why do we do this, right? That's a right. question that I think we should ask.
Yeah, and to put those different facets of human endeavor and human wonder together in the same sentence, to me, as I said, you got me from the beginning on that. I thought that was terrific, and that's a really critical critical aspect. In that same chapter, again, this you deal a lot with Descartes, and many things you criticize critics of Descartes, who says that he wasn't interested in passion, and obviously his approach to the mind-body problem, it may not be correct, but his approach to wonder and passion is that this should be more suppressed. And again, I'm not sure that. And you, of course, think the opposite, that we need to cultivate, not dampen, wonder and awe.
Yeah, that's right. So Descartes basically has a very sophisticated theory of human emotions. So in his view, the soul is, as you know, purely disembodied. So that's res cogitans. And then you have physical stuff, our bodies, and they're res extensa. So the passions, in his view, are part of our body, right? It's physical. They are in our brain. They're in our blood pressure. So he anticipates a lot of things, like your blood pressure can rise. Mm. Your brain gets certain impressions. So he was on the right track. He talks about animal spirits, which is actually his term for like neural impulses. And he knows they're in the spine and in the brain. So it's super sophisticated. But at the same time, so he thinks our mind is purely rational, but we can't move about like that in the world. Like, we need some connection. In fact, the book was dedicated, The Passions of the Soul, to Elizabeth of Bohemia, who was, in fact, a critic of Descartes, who said, okay, how do mind and body interact if they're two different things? How do they interact? And he thought our emotions are the way. And I think he's on the right track. So I'm not a dualist, right? I'm not a dualist. But I do think that, indeed, even if you think reason, rationality is important, you still need something to sort of know where are you going to put your energy? What are you going to put attention to? And that's exactly what he talks about, that actually our minds are informed by, for example, wonder, which he calls the first of the passions. Mm. That's basically when we see something for the first time. We don't immediately rush to make an opinion. You first let it sort of impact you. And that's the sense of wonder. It's like a sort of non-judgmental letting things impact you.
So then it's a very natural transition to chapter two, which is that sudden surprise of the soul, how wonder fuels philosophy. So you talk about philosophy, which originally, of course, was all human knowledge. Natural philosophy became science. And that philosophy is born in wonder. And I think that makes sense. But give me some color on that.
So it's interesting to note that if you look at the very earliest theorizing on wonder, then you see people like, so in particular, you see in ancient Greek philosophy, you see Plato and Aristotle talk about it. And Plato thinks that wonder is a philosophical emotion. So he talks about in the Theaetetus, you have Theaetetus, a young mathematician, and then you have Socrates, and Socrates is asking him, what is knowledge? And Theaetetus tries to come up with definitions, and it all fails, like it always does in Socratic dialogue. And then he says, I'm completely discombobulated here. Like, I have such a sense of wonder. And then Plato says, ah, but wonder, that's the mark of a philosopher. You now know that you're a philosopher because you have this feeling. Hmm. So it's a philosophical emotion. But interestingly, if we go to his student Aristotle, he says that wonder is universally human. So humans began to wonder, and that's how Aristotle in the Metaphysics actually sort of situates the beginning of science. Of course, scientia in Latin, episteme, it's not exactly science as we think of it now, but still knowledge gathering in systematic fashion, what Aristotle did actually, it begins in wonder, and wonder is universally human. And then you can see this idea throughout medieval philosophy. You can see it where it plays an important role. You can see it in early modern philosophy. It becomes hugely important because we have the scientific revolution. So people begin to wonder at all sorts of things, at weird things, at bizarre things, like things they used to paper over in medieval natural philosophy. They sort of said, oh yeah, weird things like comets and the like, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about the things that are regular, you know, like the planetary motions, and explain that. But in the 17th century, people started to think, there's a lot of weird stuff out there. Like, I mean, we should pay attention to that. And so that's why wonder becomes so important in that period, in the philosophy of that period.
Chapter 3, you deal with mysteries of the mind, the psychology of awe and wonder, and this deals with the evolutionary development. Whenever I see work in evolutionary psychology, which became a field which is, you know, both criticized and utilized, you always are concerned about what they say, just so stories. I mean, something sort of makes sense, but it's really kind of an a posteriori looking back to the past and creating something that wasn't really the case. So how do you deal, talked a little bit before about whether wonder and awe is biologically and evolutionary or cultural, and we agree it's both, but chapter 3 focuses on the evolutionary side. So how would wonder and awe be generated from an evolutionary perspective?
So as I mentioned, basically to get a sense of that, we have to have a theory of emotions. And there's so many different theories, but the one that I'll end on is that emotions, so Nico Freida wrote this monograph, I think in the 1980s, on emotions, that I think is very good. So he sees emotions as kind of sort of action scripts that we can use, but they are very flexible. So like not all feelings are like that. For example, suppose you're in pain. If you're in pain, it's difficult to ignore the pain. The only thing you can do is like ignore it or not ignore it. If you're hungry, it's the same thing. So those are feelings, but not emotions. But an emotion, you can sort of choose a little bit how to deal with it. For example, you're afraid. Like, I'm afraid, but I'm still going to watch this horror movie. Or I'm afraid, and I'm not going to go into this dark alley. Right? So you have some flexibility in how to deal with it. And I think that's a very useful framework to think about things. So emotions are basically ways to help us deal flexibly with recurring problems. But I don't think that awe and wonder are sort of like hardwired in this kind of sense of that some evolutionary psychologists say. So I think there is an evolutionary basis for it, but they can be sort of flexibly cultivated in different contexts. And I could talk more about that.
Emotions recently have become more important in consciousness studies, which I've been focusing on, in terms of its importance, not just sort of as a cousin of consciousness, but being part of the causation process. So in terms of the development of what we call consciousness, emotions, some theorists are now making that very much a primary issue, which correlates very well with what you're saying.
That's right. So one guiding thread that I found very useful is basically Lewontin's ideas of organisms as agents. So there is this old idea that in order to understand evolution, that we have to see organisms as basically objects, you know, that evolutionary pressures push down on them. And you know, like you can, and that's how you change. That's how evolution happens. But so Lewontin said, like, that's just part of the story, because animals do, they are, well, organisms, not just animals, but also, say, plants, they do have certain ways to respond, right? They're active. And emotions are precisely the sort of thing that allows us to really actively respond to our environment and not be just passive, you know, recipients of whatever gets thrown at us, but actually, you know, do things and shape our own environment in the process as well.
Another approach to emotion, and as a backdrop for psychology of awe and wonder, is the tension or dichotomy between cognitivists and non-cognitivists, people who think cognitively that emotion is sort of a, it sounds contradictory, a rational approach of the mind, and others who think that's not the case. And there's been another trend in consciousness studies over the last maybe 15 years of the importance of embodied or an activism, that there's mm-hmm. this interactions between the sentient entity and the environment that is not just an action, but it is that is a necessary component of creating that consciousness to begin with. So how do you see that, the cognitivists versus non-cognitivists?
I think if you start with somebody like Descartes, although there are various interpretations of his work, that he is really sort of like a typical cognitivist, right? Because basically the rational mind, in his view, is aided by the information that passions give you. The passions, the emotions, they help you to pay attention to the right things. But then you have the non-cognitivist idea of that, like emotions are more like our response when we become aware to physical bodily responses, as William James would put it, like who's a sort of like one of the figures who exemplifies this. So I think that actually it's plausible that both of those things play a role in our emotions. So I have taken both on board. And in addition, I think that embodied cognition is a very fruitful and handy program. And I found it unexpected to find strong resonances with continental philosophy, continental philosophers like Maurice Merleau-Ponty and Jean-Paul Sartre, who exactly anticipated these ideas, you know, several decades before cognitive psychologists got really interested in that.
Yeah, that's right. And there's another area which relates to both of the things that has been called neurophenomenology. Right. Which has been developed by first Varela and Evan Thompson and Michelle Bitball and others have developed trying to get neuroscience as opposed to being just totally analytic to somehow work with phenomenology. It's a challenge, but I think it's a very good one.
Yes.
Okay, so then in the next three chapters, as you said, chapter 4 on magic, 5 on religion, and 6 on science, we'll go through each one a little bit more. But, you know, I was a little surprised to find magic, very pleasantly surprised in this category. And my first thought is that science may not like to be so classified, given equal weight to magic and religion.
I found it different
than both magic and religion, and wouldn't want to be in that club. As Groucho Marx said, he wouldn't want to join any club that would take him for that would admit him as a member. So
I would say that actually, just centuries ago, philosophers were very interested in magic, and one of the reasons they were interested in magic is that it has two aspects, and I think the two aspects are what explains why we still are interested in magic. Namely, on the one hand, it's a source of wonderment, and on the other hand, it is a power. So when you go to watch a magic show, then those two things come together. On the one hand, you see somebody who's capable of doing something impossible. Like you have somebody who like can make an elephant disappear into thin air and other things like that. Like, you know, this cannot happen and you see it happening. So that prompts your wonder, because immediately you think, what's the trick? What's the trick? And so this wonder and power are so very much enmeshed in magic that it's philosophically interesting. Because it relates to questions of epistemology, like what are the limits of what is possible, and like how can we in fact transgress? Can we do things that seem impossible? And that's just an enduringly interesting question, right? How far can we go?
Do you differentiate between hard magic and soft magic?
That's right, yeah. So I use this distinction from Brandon Sanderson, the very popular writer of science fiction and fantasy, where he says hard magic is magic that is almost like a science, like it's like a set of rules. In fact, a lot of like modern magic systems, like if you play art tabletop role-playing games, like that has hard magic. So like there's clear rules, like if you're that kind of wizard, you can do this kind of stuff. On the other hand, you have soft magic, and soft magic is like, you don't know how it works. Like you don't know the rules, you don't know how it works. And it's just a sense of wonderment. So the wonder there becomes very, very salient.
You have a short section on the neuroscience of magic where you show that different kinds of effects can show literally different aspects during with fMRI studies in the brain and the blood flow, that different magic experiences will create more activity in certain areas of the brain.
That's right. So we know like that wonder. So actually already an 18th century philosopher like Adam Smith said that wonder and surprise are not the same thing. And you can see in these studies why. So you have a coin, the coin lies on a cloth, and in the surprise condition, all of a sudden a hand swoops in and puts the coin away. You didn't expect that, so you're surprised. But then in the magic condition, cloth goes over, cloth goes away, coin is gone. Now, interestingly, you do actually expect that when you hear a magical trick is going to happen. You know the coin is going to go away. So you're not surprised, but you wonder, and you can see a clear difference in neural signature, where people are starting to look, like you can see areas that are involved with like sort of self-evaluation, thinking about like what knowledge do I have, more active when you are wondering at something.
Hmm. Okay, chapter 5, deal with religion, and this certainly would be the first thing one might think about in terms of wonder and awe, because it would seem to be more fundamental in a religious sense. You use once again this term cognitive technology as applied to religion in terms of what it does. So talk a little bit about wonder and awe in religion, and not in the, you know, the normal sense, because we all know that, but in terms of the cognitive science involved.
So in terms of cognitive technologies, what I'm talking about is basically we have awe and wonder at things, but we can actually use certain cultural means to help us to awe, to have awe and wonder. So here's just one example, and this is actually me drawing on Abraham Joshua Heschel, the Jewish philosopher, that okay, you look outside and it's a beautiful day and the flowers just come out and you have a sense of wonder. But it could also just be that, yeah, you know, the flowers are coming out and you just don't even see it anymore. So his worry was that eventually you get sort of blunted, like, you know, life is difficult and we don't always take the time. So in his view, and it's a view that I develop along cognitive science lines, you can use specific religious practices to help you become aware of wondrous things. So he talks about these Jewish blessings that people of Jewish faith will say when they see, for example, trees flowers for the first time, or when they see a rainbow, or even when they begin to eat. So you become aware of these things and you wonder at them, whereas you might, because, you know, life is tough, you might not wonder at them otherwise. And you see it actually in several traditions. So I talk about Zen Buddhism, where you have koans, which are these riddles. Mm. And the way these riddles, they sort of push you out of your normal, you know, day-to-day thinking. They help you to think about things a bit differently. And they are also a wonder technology.
Yeah, in Judaism, we talk about the days of awe between Rosh Hashanah, which is like the new year, and Yom Kippur, roughly 10 days later, which is the Day of Atonement, and when you fast. And this is a period of time, if you're religious, that you think of the people that you wronged during the year and tell them, ask for their forgiveness or whatever. But I have known this my whole life without meaning, but reading your book and these days being defined days of awe, that's literally the expression that's used, was very highly resonant.
I find it also useful to think about that you can't make yourself happy, right? You can't just say, okay, I'm going to be really happy now. It doesn't work. But you can make yourself wander. Like, I can't say, okay, I'm going to wander right now. But it is actually the case, and we've seen this in diary studies, that if you think, okay, if you remember, okay, I've got to try to wander at things, that actually you do. So that's what makes religion, why these days of all work, because you know, okay, this is, these are days that I should be more attuned to the universe, to things around me, right? Mm. So that's an important reason why it works, I think.
Well, I just would want to qualify that what we're talking about, the importance of wonder and awe in religion, how it works in terms of our lives, this conversation really is totally independent of whether religion is real in the sense that there is an ultimate reality behind the religion, that God exists or whatever the tradition happens to believe, which is a totally separate question. We like to deal with that on Closer to Truth also, but that's not this question, that the issues of wonder and awe are efficacious as a cultural mechanism. I don't want to say artificial in terms of it being wrong, but it's part of a cultural mechanism that would be true irrespective one way or the other. And so this analysis, I think, is a completely agnostic about the ultimate foundation of any individual religion.
I think that's right. But there is a problem. It's almost a paradox that Heschel talks about as well. Like, once you start using something as a concrete means to an end, like, okay, I'm going to just wander, like, I don't know if this is all real or not, but I'm just going to wander to you know, for my mental health, and then I'll be more productive and things like that. That's not going to work. So that's a bit of the problem. So you do have to have a certain earnestness, I think, when you engage in those practices. It doesn't matter if you believe it. Yeah.
You're right. But there are two, you know, I think we're both saying something that's right, but they're different. What you're saying is that one has to believe it themselves to make it work. You can't fool yourself. Oh, I'm going to just use religion but I don't really believe it. That won't work. You have to believe it yourself. What I'm saying is that from a third party point of view, an independent point of view, if we see that person needs to believe it to make the awe and wonder work. But from our point of view, to make sense of the system, we don't need there to be a reality behind it, although that person who experiences it must have it.
That's right, yeah. So my view is completely outlined in the book, is completely naturalistic. So none of this has to be real. Like, magic doesn't have to be real. you know, the religious entities don't have to be real. We can explain how it works and why it works from a cognitive science perspective without any of this being real. So that's right.
Right. But I think the point that you made before is really interesting. The person who is having the awe and wonder can't do it in an that they feel it's an artificial contrivance. They have to believe it to make it work.
That's right. There's so much work now in philosophy. So you have Alain de Botton and other people like that who say, like, couldn't people who are not religious, bit of different discussion, but couldn't they just use religious means to, like, make secular temples and stuff like that? And it's tricky, right? It's a different discussion, but it's interesting to think, like, can a secular, purely secular person, how would they, you know, develop wonder and awe? And they do, like, they have wonder and awe. Like, everybody has this feeling.
No, sure.
And it's interesting.
And many scientists have worked to show that the awe and wonder in science and approaches is great and even greater than a religious approach. You know, that's a whole other kind of discussion to really analyze what we mean. So let's go to chapter 6, which is on awe and wonder in science, and you use it in general. My question in reading through that chapter was, you know, I see more wonder than awe, at least in most scientific activities. And then you have a section on when paradigm shifts, the Thomas Kuhn approach, that awe and wonder plays maybe a greater role in paradigm shifts. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's basically, there you have, I think, awe does play a role. So in everyday science, so we have actually work on this. So there is published work on that scientists do have frequent experiences of awe and wonder when they just go through their day-to-day work. But then sometimes there is this problem, right, that things don't work anymore, anomalies accumulate. And then the question is, what happens? And Bas van Frassen, the great Dutch philosopher of science, has this beautiful book, The Scientific Image, where he outlines this theory. It's a very underappreciated theory, but I love it. The theory is the following.
We love Bas. He's a major part of Closer to Truth, so he's our favorite.
He's great.
Other than you, of course.
So Bas van Frassen has this idea that it is not on purely rational grounds that scientists choose new directions when they notice that the old directions don't work. And he uses actually Jean-Paul Sartre's idea on the emotions. It's a little book that Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, a little sketch of the emotions, where he says emotions are not so much things that passively happen to you, but things that you do. You use emotions to actually help you deal with all sorts of problems in the world. And actually, this is an approach that I'm very sympathetic to. And in the case of paradigm shifts, what happens is, well, Bas van Frassen says that scientists, they use their emotions. But I thought, like, what emotions? Well, it's got to be awe and wonder. And awe here is I think, very useful because the nice thing with it is you don't immediately have to make a decision. You only have to say, like, wow, this new theory, like, say, for example, Darwinian evolutionary theory at the time when it came out, people were quite astounded. Like, it didn't come out of nowhere. There were the evolutionary theories before Darwin, but Darwin and Wallace's theory was so neat, and it made people stand in awe, and it was really one of the reasons that people chose to go with that.
Yeah, when I read chapters 5 and 6 between philosophers and scientists, I recall that famous kind of quip. I heard it from, it was George Bernard Shaw, but I think that's questioned others, that philosophers are people who know less and less about more and more until they know nothing about everything, while scientists are people who know more and more about less and less. So in the end, they know everything about nothing.
So that's
I
love
my,
it.
My favorite philosopher science joke.
Yeah, I love it. I aspire to that, like knowing nothing about everything. Right. Yeah. I love the scope.
So in chapter 7, you kind of broaden your horizon using Rachel Carson's view on wonder and engaging with our moral dealings with the environment and appreciation of the more immediate impact to the entire world based upon awe and wonder, which is expanding its remit.
That's right. So in chapter 7, I talk about Carson specifically because I think she has an interesting way to look at wonder as a kind of virtue. So up until that point in the book, I discuss wonder as an emotion. But since I do think that you can cultivate your emotions and that we can use those emotions to do work for us, as is in the case in scientists who do cultivate it to some extent, well, in that chapter, I'm thinking about, like, how can we use our emotions to, you know, to help us? Not in this sort of like, oh, yeah, let's become more productive or let's use them to, like, just increase for purely functional ends a certain things that we do, but just for us to be in the world in a certain way, in a certain, you know, like, so lots of people have lots of anxiety these days. Like, it's been a really tough few years for many people for various reasons. And well, wonder is, as Carson said, it's a source of resilience. It's a sort of source of, you can draw strength from wonder, which I think is a beautiful way that she put that.
And then in chapter 8, which is your epilogue, you talk about reclaiming, which naturally follows on from chapter 7 and Rachel Carson, reclaiming our sense of wonder and why that's important. To reclaim it. And I was just focusing on the word reclaim. Does that mean you think that there was a period of time in which humanity had a better sense of wonder? It's not, you don't say claiming our sense of wonder in a new sense, but reclaiming as though it's something we lost.
I think so. This is, again, actually a whole discussion. So you have people like Heidegger who would say, yeah, we had more wonder like before the modernity. So some ideas that modernity actually destroyed a lot of wonder because it made intelligible things that before we would explain the fairies are doing it or something like that, or God made it, that now we know are just natural phenomena. And so there is that idea. But on the other hand, what I've argued throughout the book is that actually science is a major source of wonder. It's a source of wonder because it gives us all sorts of things that we didn't know were the case, like when those James Webb telescope pictures came. Like, wasn't everybody wondering at the same time? It was a beautiful shared experience. So I don't think that there was a sort of golden age that we all had awe and wonder. I don't think that's the case. But I do think that lately, many people are sort of almost like over, you know, they're seeing themselves in this very utilitarian fashion. Like, I've got to produce, I've got to, you know, like I have got to jump through a number of hoops. I have to make sure to buy a house and pension savings. And all of that, I feel that as that is getting more and more the case, like you see it now with AI as well, like, okay, how can we maximize? You know, there's all this thing about maximizing our efficiency. And the question is like, for what? What are we doing it for? So in that respect, I do think that we have lost, even over the last few decades, we've lost some ability to just stand in awe and to wonder.
Well, I recommend Wonderstruck to everybody. It's a different way of thinking about all the topics we deal with on Closer to Truth in science and philosophy and religion in its specific ways that one can appreciate these topics, Closer to Truth's cosmos, consciousness, and meaning from a totally different perspective through Helen's eyes on Wonderstruck. So many thanks, Helen. We could go on for hours, but I want to tell all viewers that they can watch all 16 special videos with Helen DeCruz on the Closer to Truth website and most on the Closer to Truth YouTube channel, along with over 1,000 Closer to Truth videos and dozens of TV episodes on consciousness, all facets of consciousness, brain mechanisms, free will, personal identity, panpsychism, dualism, idealism, even parapsychology, life after death, cosmic consciousness, all of these kinds of questions and more is coming in the future. So thanks, everyone. By the way, it's all infused with critical thinking. So we all have to take critical thinking to all of these aspects, which Helen has done marvelously in Wonderstruck. Helen, thank you very much. Good to see you again. And we'll do it again soon.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really delightful. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for watching. See you next time.
To watch complete conversations with over 100 of the world's leading thinkers on cosmos, consciousness, and meaning, visit our website, closertotruth.com.